Welcome to Israel War Briefing, a podcast from the Jewish Chronicle offering deep insight into the crisis in the Jewish state as it continues to unfold. I'm Jake Wallace-Simons, editor of the Jewish Chronicle and author of Israelophobia, the newest version of the oldest hatred and what to do about it. In each episode, I'll be asking an expert commentator for their analysis of the latest developments and reflections on what comes next.
So I'm pleased to be joined today by Rabbi Shmuley Boteach, who of course needs no introduction. He's been described by the Washington Post as the most famous rabbi in America, and indeed by the Jerusalem Post as one of the most influential Jews in the world. And he's no stranger to controversy. He's the author of 31 books, including Kosher Sex, famously, in 1999, and Kosher Jesus in 2012, and lots of other books as well. He's a broadcaster and a relationships expert. So Rabbi Shmuley, I'm really excited for you to join us. Thank you so much for joining the Jewish Chronicle.
Thank you for having me, Jake. Thank you.
So I thought that it would be really interesting for our listeners and our viewers on YouTube just to hear from you a little bit about what made you you, your father, your parents, your upbringing. Where do you come from as a person, first of all?
Well, I'm a Jewish American. I was born in Los Angeles. My parents divorced when I was a young boy, 8. That famously had a very painful impact on my life. It's funny because divorce today is so commonplace, people don't think twice about it, but I did. It bothered me tremendously. My mother moved us to Miami, where her parents were, so I was raised in Miami. But that's what got me writing books about relationships, because by the time I came to become the rabbi at Oxford University November 1988, the students were having terrible relationships, meaningless hookups. Sex was not something, it was recreational, but it caused a lot of pain, breakups, et cetera. But I was always thinking about how to keep two people together, because that was instilled into my childhood, what happened with my parents' marriage. And it's still something that, occupies my mind a great deal. How do we create strong and healthy families? Because Jewish people did not have a homeland for 2,000 years. Our homeland was the family dinner table. The Mizbeach, or the daily altar, was breaking bread with our children. And it's amazing that we were able to sustain an identity in exile for 2,000 years because of those strong families, strong communities. It begins with family. But at the age of about 8 or 9, I started going to Chabad camp. I became very influenced by Chabad. I think if I want to look at it honestly, the young Chabad rabbinical students were even almost like father figures to me. My counselors started studying at yeshivas because my father was in LA and we were in Miami. And this was not, now we all use planes like taxis. That was not the case back then. So I saw my father, many times a year, but certainly not enough.
Can I just pause you?
A very big impact on my life. Yeah,
sure. I mean, I'm just interested to hear more about your father, because as I understand it, he was of Persian origin. Correct. Is that correct?
My father was born in Esfahan, Iran. My grandfather had 13 children. Thank God, he was a very passionate Zionist.
Right.
And he wanted to move to Israel, so they moved in the early 1950s when. Obviously, Israel was dirt poor. They lived in a tent, and they lived in the city of Holon, which is now a nice suburb of Tel Aviv. But then it was called Holon because it was all sand, and they lived on sand dunes. Then they moved to Be'er Sheva, even poorer area in the south, because one of my uncles had asthma. He needed better air, the clean desert air. And my parents met. My mother was an American Jew from New York, and she went on a trip. And she asked a handsome young Israeli where she could buy the best falafel. That was my father. So they married and they lived in Israel, actually. But then my mother, a New Yorker, as my grandfather needed more help with, business, things like that. My parents moved to the U.S. and it was supposed to be temporary. But they ended up moving to Los Angeles. And that's where I was born. My father instilled in me a phenomenal love of Israel. My mother instilled in me a phenomenal love of Israel. I just lost both of them over the past 3 years. So it's been a very painful
thing. I'm sorry to hear that.
And in fact, just 2 weeks ago, we had my mother's first yahrzeit, where we dedicated a Torah to my mother and to Shani Luke, the most famous victim of the October 7th massacre. And we brought her parents, Nissim Luke, Ricardo Luke, who's a German Jewish convert to Judaism. And with Robert Kennedy, we celebrated the life of Shani Luke. And it was, I consider her, I know we're getting off topic a little bit, but I consider Shani Luke. Why did we choose her? There were, you know, 1,200 victims. I believe that she is arguably the most desecrated woman in the history of the world, because about 1 billion people watched a video of her stripped naked and her dead body being beaten by men, abused by men. So we dedicated the Torah to her.
Mm. Okay. And in terms of your Jewish heritage and inheritance, I'm interested by the fact that you've got the, I suppose, the Ashkenazi tradition of your mother, and your father is a sort of Mizrahi, I suppose, a Mizrahi tradition. I call myself
Ashkenazi, but I was. Right. But then you have to add the whole Chabad element, because yeah. I'm really Chabad in terms of my customs. I'm Ashkenazi. You know, it's funny. Israel, of course, is now being treated as a colonialist European experiment went awry that. You know, all of our haters say that we're occupiers, took their land. My father was never white. That's, you know, that's the interesting thing about this whole thing, that this is an apartheid experiment. When my father came to New York, when he married my mother was Ashkenazi, other Jews, believe it or not, called him Shvarza. They called him, he was a black Jew. My father was never white. My father's family was never white. Iranian Jews are not white. You know, many Mizrahi Jews are, if you want to use today's identity politics colloquial vernacular, they would be brown. But my customs, of course, were all Chabad, because I met the Rebbe when I was about 10, and he became my Rebbe. And so I live a Chabad life, and all my customs are Chabad.
And can you just talk a little bit about what the Rebbe was like as a person, what it was like meeting him, and what you remember of him?
Oh, yeah. Well, I had the great privilege of really kind of getting to know the Rebbe as much as a chassid could know the Rebbe. The Rebbe had tens of thousands of chassidim around the world. But at my bar mitzvah, I got a private audience with the Rebbe. I actually discussed this audience once on the BBC when I lived in England. And I remember they told me it was one of the longest segments in any documentary. It was on Panorama, because they didn't cut it. But basically, the story is that I went into the Rebbe and it was 3 o'clock in the morning. And they had to put a hat on me, and I was swimming, and the hat was too big. They just shoved someone's hat on me, and they had to put a jacket on me, and I was swimming in a jacket as well. It was 3 o'clock in the morning, and the Rebbe asked me when my bar mitzvah was, and I told him, and then I gave him the letter that you're supposed to give him, and he took out a little pencil and began to circle things. And in the letter, I wrote that I had become very cynical about life, even at 13, because my parents divorced. If the people who brought you into this world suddenly fragment, and if their union dissolves, like, what does that mean about your entire existence? Is it a mistake? So the Rebbe looked at me and said to me, "You're too young to be a cynic." And then he gave me a blessing, and I had tears streaming down my eyes, because he had these piercing blue eyes in which I saw an ocean of compassion. And he said to me, "You will grow to be a source of light, inspiration, joy, and nachas to your school," he said first, "your family, the Jewish people, and the entire world." And wow, I mean, giving a 13-year-old, a cynical 13-year-old, a belief in himself that he could have a global impact. Who speaks to teenagers like that? We treat teenagers like children. And I'm not going to say that I walked out of that 3 minute and 33 second. It was 3 o'clock in the morning. I remember, it was 3 minutes, 33 second meeting transformed. I will say that it was one of the highlights of my life that I think about constantly. And then when I became the Rebbe's personal emissary to Oxford, he took a great interest in my work. Because remember, the Rebbe was a product of world-famous universities. He went to the Sorbonne, he went to the University of Berlin just before the Holocaust, just before Hitler's rise to power. In fact, after Hitler's rise to power, about 1933. So he really cared about Oxford. And when I went to Oxford, there were only, you know, you just told me that you were in Oxford in 1999. Which college were you at?
Yeah. St. Peter's.
St. Peter's, okay. Yeah. Oh, so that was just down the road. You were very near us, our offices. But Oxford never had more than between 600 to 1,000 Jewish students any given year. And Chabad now has emissaries at every campus. Back then, there were only maybe 10, 15 campuses. So why Oxford? I mean, why didn't we go to Harvard first, where there were 5,000 Jewish students, NYU, 6,000 Jewish students? And I think it's because the Rebbe understood that Oxford was one of the crossroads of Western intellectual civilization, and that people from there would go on to make a very big impact. Here you are, Jake. You're the editor of the world's oldest English language Jewish newspaper. Some of our students became senators, like Cory Booker, with whom I would have he was my closest friend. We famously had a falling out over his Iran vote in 2015. We could talk about that if you want. But the mayor of Los Angeles, Eric Garcetti, now America's ambassador to India. But for me, most importantly, Israel's minister of strategic affairs, Ron Dermer, who was Israel's ambassador to the United States for 8 years, really like a brother to me till this very day, who's on one of the people in the five-person war cabinet. He was our Chaim Society president from 94 to 96. Mm-hmm. The Rebbe kind of foresaw that a lot of these students would have an outsized impact.
Right. And you've spoken really quite a lot, because we've only been speaking for quite a short time, but you've mentioned your parents' divorce several times. And I just wonder, and you mentioned that they sadly died this year, and may you have a long life, and Baruch Adonai Haemet. I just wondered how you look at that now in retrospect, and have you come to terms with what that all meant, and how does it inform the way that you think and who you are today?
No, I never will. And, you know, I accept that brokenness is part of the human condition. And while therapy can help, and many people believe in it, and some people question it, and whether whatever we do to heal, religion, self-exploration, self-examination, meditation, I accept that the Shvirata Kelim, that this ancient Kabbalistic idea that the world is kind of comprised of fragmented pieces that we try to make whole, we don't always have the glue that's going to remove those little jagged edges. And there's parts of our personality that will always be broken. I think that my parents' divorce had a permanent impact on my life. And the interesting thing is that, you know, divorce is lifelong. Like, you have to, even after I was married with children, I had to decide every Pesach, do I take my kids to my father? Do I take my kids to my mother? Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, you know? And you're always kind of offending one when you go to the other. But now I've discovered, this is the first time I've ever discussed this, even in death, it continues. Because my father died in May 2020, 4 years ago, nearly 4 years ago, at the beginning of the COVID pandemic. And we miraculously buried him in Israel when it was impossible, on Har HaZaitim, on Mount of Olives, right near Menachem Begin, who was his hero. And my wife and I just purchased, because the plots, there's almost nothing left, it's the world's holiest Jewish cemetery, I quickly bought plots near my father. For me and my wife, a strange thing to have to confess to, but, you know, in the Jewish religion, it's supposed to be a skula l'arichut yamim, that if you buy a burial plot, you're supposed to live longer. But anyway, so without sounding macabre, and it says Shamor b'chayim, and it says my name, reserved in life and your name. And I said to my wife, by the way, God forbid, if we get divorced, God forbid, that's going to be really awkward. So now that we have these plots next to each other, we got to get along. And by the way, it's interesting because today is our actual English wedding anniversary, our 36th.
Oh, Mazel tov.
Thank you. So we celebrate our Jewish one with the 24th of Adar. But anyway, I remember my brother and sister saying to me, what, you're going to be buried next to Abba and not next to Mommy? Like, even in divorce, you need to choose, because my mother's buried in New York, my father's buried in Israel. So, no, I think it had a permanent impact on my life. And first of all, it governs the books that I write. It governs so much of the social media that I do, so much of the writing that I do, relationships, sexuality, parenting, all of those things. But it also governs, the conversations I have with my wife. You know, I have very introspective conversations about how this has impacted me. And now, sadly, I'm 57 years old and I'm orphaned. I've had to contend with the loss of both parents. In 3 years, I lost both my parents. And I have to say that I know we love saying, you know, my father was 87, my mother was 80. She was in amazing health. She had a beautiful 80th birthday party we all put on for her. You could see the videos of her dancing, and we lost her 2 months later. We didn't know that she had stage 4 cancer. So I've been devastated by my parents' death. I know that we love saying, oh, they had a long life. And I'm amazed at how much a parent's death devastates you and makes you think, and it changes you. And I wrote a whole book. And here I want to give everyone who's watching advice. When my father died, I wrote a book about my year of Kaddish, because I had to say Kaddish during coronavirus. And I didn't miss one Kaddish, 3 minyanim a day, outdoors, even in New York when we were, you know, knee deep in snow. I got 10 men and I said Kaddish 3 times a day for my father. And I wrote a book about it. And it's called Good Morning with a U, you know, Good Morning. And I dedicated it to my mother, and I presented it to my mother. And I said, the dedication said, I will never go through a year of grief again. I will embrace the Rebbe's vision that Mashiach will come and we can all attain eternal life. And I gave it to my mother, and then I lost my mother 6 months later. Moral of the story is, never, you know, don't dedicate a book to a parent about issues that serious. Anyway, so it's still very much.
And just before we leave this topic, I'm just curious to know how you feel about your parents now. Do you Do you blame them for their divorce? Have you accommodated it? How do you understand it?
No, I have ideas about marriage, parenting, relationships that not everybody agrees with. I believe that there's an essential compatibility between most men and women, meaning I believe that attraction is more important than compatibility. And so long as if you take a man and a woman who are heterosexual and heterosexually inclined, in most cases, that union can work, last, and even a lifetime. But there are rules. There are basic rules to a relationship, like there are rules to everything else. My parents seem to be culturally incompatible because of maybe the Ashkafardi thing. My father was raised in Iran. My mother was raised in New York. She was a Western woman. They were very different. But even then, that's not really why they divorced. I think that the basic marriages are about really the small things. They're not about remembering what I just mentioned, my own anniversary today. Thank God I didn't forget. They're really about daily compliments. They're about a 4-to-1 compliment to criticism ratio. They're about having a very healthy sex life, erotic life. I am famous for emphasizing that the intimate life of a husband and wife is critical because desire is critical. The holiest book of the 24 books of the Tanakh, of the Jewish biblical canon, the Talmud says, is amazingly Shir HaShirim, which is a very explicit sex love poem written by King Solomon. Some of its verses are positively scandalous. And Rabbi Akiva
is a metaphor.
The Holy of Holies. I'm sorry?
Right. It's a metaphor for people's relationship with God, isn't it? It's
remember, no en mikro yotze mide pshuto, no verse loses its literal meaning. What you just said, interestingly, the rabbis were so uncomfortable with how explicit it was with I grabbed the grapes of your breast. And, you know, so they said, oh, this is all metaphorical. None of it is literal. And it speaks to the natural religious discomfort that we religious people have always had with sex. What it ended up doing, of course, was destroying sex in Catholicism. Look at all the sexual scandals that Catholicism has suffered over the. And Catholicism, by the way, is one of the great forces for good in the world. It runs more schools than any other movement. It runs more hospitals than any movement. And yet so many people think it's filled with pedophiles, which is tragic. We cannot suppress the sexual urge. It's not healthy. And it's especially not healthy in marriages. When I first started counseling married couples, and I started discovering they would come because they couldn't communicate, or they would come because they're fighting over money, or they came to me because the mother-in-law was interfering in the marriage. Amazingly, 8 times out of 10, they weren't having sex, but they had never mentioned that. Right. And that means there was no desire. You didn't feel special. Now, some of them were having affairs. Interestingly, now when people come for counseling, they're really not. I think affairs have really been reduced, but by something perhaps even more pernicious, perhaps not as painful, but more pernicious. And that is pornographic addiction, which is affecting about 1 in 4 men. 1 in 4 men in America look at porn for an hour a day. Now, when you remove your erotic interest in your wife, because it's usually men looking at this stuff, with that much vigor, it's not only that you may be, you're offending your wife, et cetera, you're also deserting your marriage because your marriage becomes a barren landscape. You're not looking at the woman in your wife. You're seeing her as the mother of your children. I believe strongly when desire is lost in a relationship, you're essentially in a prison cell trapped because you have kids or a mortgage, et cetera. And marriage is supposed to be something that we not only live in and engage in, but it's supposed to be something that we choose daily.
Now, I asked you about your parents and their divorce in the beginning, and we've gone on to your ideas, which are obviously linked strongly to that. But I'm just interested just to pin you to that. Just how do your thoughts now interpret your parents to yourself in terms of their divorce?
Well, you know, my parents divorced in the 1990s, and we were an Orthodox family. It was very uncommon. Today, if you're married, it's uncommon. So it's almost like as time went on, they became even less culpable, less liable, because everybody was divorced. But I didn't look at it in terms of what was happening to other people. I wish they had stayed together. At my bar mitzvah, they famously asked me, what do you want? And this is 5 years after they had separated. What do you want for your bar mitzvah? I said, I want you to remarry. I didn't get that present. I no longer think about whether they should have married or divorced. I really think about what my obligations are now to my family. You cannot control what your parents are going to do, and you don't have a lot of control over your childhood. you do have control over what you can learn from your childhood and your own experiences in terms of the family that you create. Listen, we have 9 children, thank God. 5 of them are married now. I have 4 sons-in-law, 1 daughter-in-law, 2 sons in the IDF right now, both in the war, and a daughter-in-law who's in the IDF as well. So I say that because, when your children marry, there's a whole new thing to navigate. You have to navigate relationships with children who are not your children, right? They're someone else's child. They married each other. They call you, Tati or Abba or Shver, which is the Yiddish for father-in-law. That's a whole new set of things. And then you have grandchildren. And with us, our grandchildren are so close in age to our youngest child. I have a daughter who's 15, and our eldest grandchild is almost 12, is only 3 years. Wow. So there was not a break. And so I think if I had to say, how does my parents' divorce affect me till this very day? It's not in thinking what they did wrong. It's rather in thinking, maybe I'm too self-conscious. Maybe I'm too psychologically invested in thinking always, am I a good father? Am I a good husband? Am I a good grandfather? Am I a good father-in-law? When really, I often say to my kids, I wish it was more organic, that I'm just, that it happens naturally, that it flows naturally, because I'm constantly asking myself, did I see my grandchildren enough this week? I call my children every Friday to give them a bracha for Shabbat. And so I think that's how it continues to affect me. And as the years go by, and I'm middle-aged now, I do want it to be more organic. But when you're a child of divorce, it's harder for it to flow naturally. It does become something more self-conscious, where you are more self-conscious as to whether or not you're doing something wrong.
Right. So let's just take you on a bit before we're going to talk about the post-October the 7th world in a few minutes. But just before we go there, I just wanted to ask you, because you became obviously a huge global star from your time in Oxford, and then afterwards with your books and your TV appearances and so on and so forth. And for me personally, that was symbolized when I was there when Michael Jackson and Uri Geller came to speak at the Oxford Union, and you were there too. So to be friendly with Michael Jackson and all the other stars that you were friendly with,
you were actually in the Oxford Union.
I was there in the Oxford Union.
It's funny you mentioned that just for a moment. I organized that whole thing. Obviously, I was very close to the union in my 11 years at Oxford, and I had to push Michael very hard to do it. Michael only really gave 2 speeches in his life, and both of them are speeches that we gave together. One was at Carnegie Hall. He didn't sing at Carnegie Hall. He spoke at Carnegie Hall, and then there was this Oxford thing.
Yeah.
But Michael made a very big mistake in, once I was trying to rehabilitate Michael and get him off prescription drug abuse, which would come up, without him wanting to come up, you would just see it. And when trying to rehabilitate his reputation, because remember, till today, people debate, was Michael Jackson a pedophile? Was he not? He was never convicted of anything. And to the extent that we want to follow the law of the land, we can't call him a pedophile. But there were these suspicions. And I told him, what this means is you can never again work with children. But what you can do is you can work with their parents. You could give a message about almost a bill of rights for kids. I mean, simple things. A child has a right to be read a bedtime story that their parent doesn't say, okay, the light's off. A child has a right to have dinner with their parents more than just Thanksgiving and Christmas. And that was the speech that I wrote that speech for Michael, essentially, with him. And that was, if you remember, it was a bill of rights for children. But Michael's management were always trying to leverage and make money off everything that he did. So they didn't let us, they did a professional recording of that speech. I remember the guy that did it. They wouldn't let us take a recording of it. And it's a shame, because it was a monumental evening. And the reviews that he got that night, if you remember, Uri spoke, then I spoke and introduced Michael, then Michael gave his speech, and he got a standing ovation from everyone that was there. I can't believe that you were in the room. That's amazing.
Yeah.
We don't know where that recording is, meaning it's somewhere in the Michael Jackson archives, and it would be such a help to his legacy, which is now making this comeback. Almost very few people came back from Me Too. He did. The biggest Broadway musical right now is MJ, and now that's a biopic. I don't know a lot about the biopic which is being made. And if we could see that, but no one knows where it is. And because Michael said to me, please, Shmuley, give in to the... Even the union wasn't allowed to do a recording.
Right.
That. So
right.
They don't have it. They have pictures that we all did, but there's, and it's a shame. Anyway, I wonder where it is.
So it's the missing Michael Jackson tape.
It is.
But Shmuley, can you tell me something about Michael Jackson that you never told anybody else before?
Yeah, he loved the Jewish people. And I think he loved my Jewishness. We celebrated Hanukkah together. even when we did, you know, we did Thanksgiving, and I said to him, Michael, you know, you do realize, first of all, Michael joining us for Thanksgiving was a little bit sad because where's his family, right? Thanksgiving for Americans, I know that if, for the British who are watching this, they may not understand just how much sacredness Americans accord Thanksgiving. I mean, students will fly, you know, all around America for 2 days with their parents that weekend, and they'll go for that Thursday night, and they'll go home. But I said to Michael, you know, Michael, we do Thanksgiving every Friday night. And he started coming to us for Shabbat. He loves Shabbat. He wrote a beautiful article about Shabbat and published it, which you can look up.
Did he sing the song? Did he sing Eshet Chayim?
Well, I took him to the Karbach Shul on Shmini Atzeret Simchat Torah, which, of course, on October 7th, its resonance would change for all of us Jews. But he told me, and he said this on the record in the book that we wrote, my book, the Michael Jackson Tapes, he said on the record that the night I took him to the Karbach Synagogue, which is a few blocks from where we are right now, he said it was the happiest night of his life. Now, remember, there was one night where I think he won 8 Grammys in a single night. And he said that going to that shul, it's a very small shul, was the happiest night of his entire life. But here's one story that is particularly relevant in light of October 7th. Ariel Sharon became prime minister, was it 2001, something like that? And he was hated from day one. He was seen as a right-winger, et cetera. You know, there was the whole issue of Sabra and Shatila that was still hanging over him and from the 1982 First Lebanon War. And so I was with Michael in his suite at the Four Seasons Hotel in New York City. And a friend of mine who was hosting Sharon at a reception for VIPs as prime minister called me and said, hey, Shmuley, you know, we're a few blocks away with the prime minister official, bring Michael. I said, yeah, great idea. So I go to Michael and I say, you know, let's go. And his team says, you know, you're crazy. There's a picture of you and Ariel Sharon. You're going to be canceled, you know, by everybody the next day. But he said, no, he'd love to meet Sharon. So in minutes, we jumped into Michael's van. And the funny thing, if I remember correctly, the funny thing was, you know, Sharon's people wanted this. I think, and I knew Sharon, I had hosted him at Oxford. So I think if memory serves correctly, Sharon looks at me when I brought him and says, Miza Bichal, you know, who is
who's this boy?
Anyway, we got the picture. People can Google the picture, and there's Ariel Sharon, Michael Jackson, me, and Uri Geller. And that, I think, was, you know, it may not sound like a great profile in the annals of courage, but it was, because he was the biggest star in the world, and meeting an Israeli, a right-wing Israeli leader, could cost you in terms of career, and his career was just coming back, and he did it, and I'll always be grateful to him for that.
Did he have a favorite Jewish song?
I don't think he knew a lot of Jewish songs. He loved listening to Jewish songs. Whenever we were in the car, I'd put on Jewish songs, and he didn't know the words. He would kind of, but he definitely loved it, and he loved the music of the Karbach Shul.
Okay. All right, well, let's move on. There's so much to talk about. I could talk to you for hours, but let's move on to the post-October 7th world, because, you know, as I said before, offline, before we were talking, it's everything's changed for everybody. And, you know, it seems to me October the 6th feels like a million years ago. How is it for you? What are your thoughts about the anti-Semitism that's gripping America, particularly American campuses, and what meaning it has for Jews, both here and in Israel?
Look, I was one of the first people to witness the change on campuses, because right. In 1988, George Shultz recognized the PLO and Arafat, because Arafat gave some, you know, mealy-mouthed recognition to Israel's right. You know, Jews have the right to not die, essentially. So, I mean, Israel's a Jewish state. Well, that was a big change on campus, because overnight, the PLO was no longer declared a terror enterprise. And I had just arrived at Oxford in 1988. So I remember that Bassem Abu Sharif was suddenly invited to the Oxford Union. Now, I don't even know where he is today, but at the time, he was like the chief advisor to Yasser Arafat. And I couldn't. So I thought, you know, in light of this supposed conciliation, he would give a conciliatory speech. It wasn't. It was an attack on Israel. And everybody, I couldn't believe the fervor with which Oxford students were embracing these lies about Israel. So we understood back then, going back to 1988, what is that, like 34, 35 years now?
That was First Intifada, right? First Intifada sort of time.
It was before the First Intifada.
Before the First Intifada, right?
I think it was before, yeah.
Right, and okay. So it was definitely before the Second Intifada. That was the big one with the suicide bombs and that stuff, yeah.
Exactly, which also would affect my work at Oxford. Mm. I'll get to that in a second. Right. So what we decided to do, I mean, Chabad's remit on campus really is, you know, spread Judaism. What we decided to do was two things. Number one, create the L'Chaim Society that would invite non-Jewish students. And we became the second largest student organization in Oxford's history up to that point, because we had like 5,000 paying members, second only to the union itself. But the second thing we decided to do was bring all these pro-Israel speakers. So we hosted Netanyahu twice. We hosted Sharon. We hosted Shamir. We hosted six Israeli prime ministers, Peres, Rabin. Now, Rabin would famously cancel. He was in a limousine, having flown already to the UK, driving from London to Oxford when the first major bombing took place. I think it was 92, 93. And he turned you can imagine the security apparatus that was already set up in the Union for the speech. So it was given instead by the Israeli ambassador to the court of St. James. He was a Hungarian Jewish ambassador. Maybe you remember him. I can't remember his name now. Anyway, it was a tragic day. But we saw the hatred that started back then. And Netanyahu, till today, speaks often and mentions in his book, Bibi, his two visits to Oxford, where he gave these incredible speeches got standing ovations. Sharon got a standing ovation, which shocked me. And they all gave very good speeches. But we constantly were involved in Israel advocacy. The difference was there was no hatred between the Islamic students or the Middle Eastern students and the Jewish students. Those same students who created the Oxford Middle East Society were our friends who would come to us for Shabbat. And when they would often drink the Kiddush wine, I would walk over to them privately and pull them over. A lot of them were scions of world famous, very powerful Arab families. I mean, the grandson of the king of Saudi Arabia at the time, Khalid ibn Bandar, who today is the Saudi ambassador to the court of St. James in London, he would come to our Holocaust speeches. He was a very nice young man. He had 10 bodyguards walking around with him all the time. But some of these students, when they would drink the wine, I'd pull them to the side and say, you know, you come from a very famous Islamic family. You should not drink any alcohol, at least in public. And so we had that kind of, we would get them their halal meat, kosher meat. If you would have told me the kind of hatred, there was hatred of Israel, but I wouldn't say there was hatred of Jews. If you would have told me that the kind of tsunami of anti-Semitism that would grip places like Oxford or Cambridge, let alone the American universities, which arguably are as bad, perhaps even worse, I would never have believed it. Like, I remain close to Benjamin Netanyahu, and I've asked him many times, you know, why doesn't he go to the campuses more, et cetera? And it's all security. There is, if someone like Netanyahu, or even if it was Bennett before him, or even Lapid before him, before this premiership, this, you know, his third premiership, if they had tried to speak at Oxford or Harvard, I think security would say, we cannot protect you. Or that for the 1,000 students who would be there in the auditorium, you would have 100,000 outside. So we've effectively made it almost impossible for Israel to even make its case on campus. So that it's extremely serious. And it's poisoning a whole future generation of leaders. Remember, I just said to you, when I was at Oxford 30 years ago, leaving 20 years ago, I was there for 11 years, my students went on to be senators and billionaires and philanthropists and mayors and Jacob Rees-Mogg was someone I knew very well. I know he's
okay.
I mean, I can go through the list of all the, right. What's his name? Dominic Raab. There's a picture of Ron Dermer and Dominic Raab the day that he finished his exams because he was very close to Ron Dermer. I have that picture. I think I even posted it once. Well, the three of us in a pub, you know, and then he'd later go on to be foreign secretary. This whole new generation of students is being poisoned against Israel, and it's terrible.
Now, when did you last speak to Benjamin Netanyahu? Do you speak to him these days?
Well, I have not spoken to him since October 7th. I wouldn't have the chutzpah to take even a moment of the prime minister when he is at war. But I did. I was in regular communication with him before that, and I saw him in Israel. I tried to see him almost every time I was there if he had the time. Mm-hmm. He was very kind in his time with me because, like I said, we go back 34 years. In fact, let me tell you a great story about Netanyahu, why I came to love and respect him so much. Remember, Netanyahu is now controversial, which is impossible not to be when you're a prime minister fighting an existential war against a genocidal enemy, and you have everybody saying, you know, there are 8 brigades that Hamas has. Israel has destroyed 6, and there are 2 left in Rafah. And President Joe Biden, who's been exemplary in giving Israel support, is beginning to turn, not because his heart has turned on being a self-proclaimed Zionist, but because he's really having to cater in an election year to the extreme left of his party. It's almost like the city of Dearborn, Michigan, which is filled with many Muslims are our brothers, Islamists are our enemies. And I always distinguish, you know, Muslims are equally God's children. Islam is a great world religion. Islamism is nothing but a political ideology that hates the West, hates Israel, the Muslim Brotherhood, and it uses Islam as a thin veneer, the way the Nation of Islam does with, let's say, Louis Farrakhan and Elijah Muhammad. It's almost like Dearborn, Michigan, and its Islamists are now controlling the Democratic Party, because, you know, Michigan might determine who's the next president of the United States, and that one city might determine who gets the electoral votes, be that as it may. So Biden is saying to Israel, hey, we want you to defend yourselves, but you can't fight. I mean, those messages are clearly contradictory. Israel cannot leave Israel cannot leave Hamas as a functional army. But the story I wanted to tell you was, and I'm not sure I ever told the story in public. So when Netanyahu was Israeli deputy foreign minister, this is probably 91, and Moshe Levy was foreign minister, and he was the first Sephardic, very high-level Israeli politician, Likud, and under him is Netanyahu, so eloquent. So it's suddenly Netanyahu doesn't have a lot to do. Like, you know, these deputy ministers, I bring him to Oxford. So the Metropolitan Police, they have to protect him. He's a deputy Israeli minister. They bring him to the edge of Oxford, and the Oxford police take over. And I remember, I think they put us like in a white car, or maybe it was bulletproof. And there's these two detectives sitting in front driving us, and there's me and Netanyahu in the back. And it's the first time I've met Bibi. Bibi's not even married to Sarah now. He's in his 30s. Very handsome, very charismatic. And I introduce him, I hug him, I thank him for everything he's done as UN ambassador. You know, he was already a global superstar from his 4 years as the UN ambassador. And then we drive in. I say, listen, I'm going to give you a tour as we drive in. So we pass, you know, Malden College, one of the first colleges you see after the Malden Bridge. And then UNIV on the left. And I said, this is where Bill Clinton went.
Malden, you mean? Yeah, Malden. Yeah.
Malden. I said Malden, right?
Yeah.
I said Malden.
Yeah.
And then UNIV, and then you pass all the colleges. Right. And I'm saying to him, you know, the ivory towers of Oxford. Then he looks at me and he says to me, all of this history and all of this grandeur and all of this polished academic excellence, and yet Jews who were skeletons, who were starving during the Holocaust, were sitting on ships and they sent them to Cyprus and wouldn't even let them in. Like, how do you reconcile that? And remember, you have these two detectives who are supposed to be protected, listening in the front. And I remember saying to myself, God Almighty, this is a man who does not give a damn what anyone thinks. He will protect his people. And on that trip, I fell in love with him because he stayed with us like for 2 days. I got him a hotel room at the Randolph, which is probably still the fanciest hotel in Oxford. He said, don't waste your money. You know, he went upstairs in our house. And I remember he comes down in his undershirt because we had a kosher dinner for all the Rhodes Scholars before his major speech at the Union. And he says to me, Shmuley, do you have a shaver? I go,
You didn't have one, I guess.
I did not have a shaver. I think if you look at the pictures of his speech, he even looks a little bit unshaven because we could not get him a shaver.
Right, right.
But he was so we stayed close. But no, have I spoken to Mark Stover 7? No. But I have spoken to Ron Dermer, who was my student president.
Right.
And, you know, we keep in regular contact. I love
you
Ron.
Know,
Right.
And
they're very, very committed to finishing this war.
Sure.
Because Hamas cannot continue to function as an army. Will Israel be able to kill every Hamas terrorist? Of course not. But will Israel be able to destroy their effective combat readiness? Yes, they can. And that's why Rafah is going to become a seminal battle.
Yeah. Now, just about Netanyahu, I would be remiss to move the conversation on without talking about the controversy he's attracted, because it's quite rare these days, particularly in Britain, that you meet anybody who's a friend or supporter of Netanyahu these days, because of the controversies with the judicial reforms and the extremists in his cabinet and the you know, the controversies that have all surrounded that and have sort of bled into the war and the debate around that. What's your response to all of that stuff? How do you feel about it?
Well, my first response is that Israel, thank God, is a democracy, and it's the only democracy in the entire Middle East. There isn't a single Arab democracy in the entire world. So the first person that matters is the Israeli voter. What people in Britain think about, you know, that's, I'm not someone who takes the extreme position that diaspora Jewry have no right to say, you know, offer an opinion of what's happening in Israel. That's an extreme position. We do so much for Israel. Of course we can have an opinion. I can have an opinion on King Charles, and I'm an American. But ultimately, it's the Israeli voters. So to say this, you'd be hard-pressed to find people like Netanyahu. He keeps on winning election after election after election. So clearly,
although his support is really very low at the moment, though.
Well, those are polls, and who knows? We saw polls and voting are different things. But let me just say this. I don't think that there's any leaders in the world anymore of consequence who are not controversial. Everyone these days is controversial. You have Kate Middleton right now, who's extremely controversial. obviously
she's not a leader. She's not a leader of the country.
No, but she is. She exerts tremendous influence. You're not going to say that the royal family doesn't have influence.
But she doesn't compare to Netanyahu.
Okay, well, let's go through all of them, right? Yeah. I mean, let's go through all of them. Theresa May didn't even survive. Talk about someone who was unpopular. Boris Johnson was very unpopular, suddenly becomes prime minister. Stays, sure. He's going to make a comeback. Donald Trump, we thought was, 3 years ago, January 6th, we thought, finish, goodbye, distance yourself. He may be the next president. He's now beating Biden in polls. There was no one who isn't controversial of consequence anymore, because we live in an age of controversy. We live in a very strange age. Should Jews like someone like Viktor Orban, who came to the United States 2 days ago, went to see Trump, didn't go to see Biden? And why do I even ask that? Because he's pro-Israel, but he seems to be anti-Semitic. We're seeing that new phenomenon in Eastern Europe, which is a fascinating phenomenon. Pro-Israel anti-Semites. This is an age of controversy. There is no one who is not controversial. You have Jews who still support Vladimir Putin, the Jews who live there, who say, stop condemning him. You know, he's the first Russian leader who's ever treated the Jews with respect. I consider Putin a dyed in the wool killer, murderer, tyrant, dictator. But I can't tell you how many Jews say to me from Russia saying, you're doing such a disservice by saying this publicly because he protects us. And that's never happened in Russia. From the Russian Empire to the Soviet Union, Jews were decimated and murdered, and slaughtered, et cetera. There's no one who's not controversial. Is Netanyahu controversial? Absolutely. But do I believe in... But I'll tell you one thing that I really object to about Netanyahu, knowing him personally. And I knew his father very well. I brought his father to Oxford, Cambridge, London, Benzion Netanyahu. The number one goal of Benjamin Netanyahu throughout his life, and his brother, Israel's greatest war hero, the fallen Yoni Netanyahu, was and is to protect the Jewish people. When people come to me and they say to me, Netanyahu is fighting this war to stay out of jail because of charges of corruption, that is, you can hate Netanyahu's guts, but that is such a slur for someone who buried his brother, who served in Sayeret Matkal. I know what the protection of the Jewish people meant to his father, what it meant, I never knew his brother, and what it means to him. That's a slur. And let me say one more thing. Again, you can hate Netanyahu, but I just want people to be fair. When we talk about charges of corruption, Netanyahu was being tried for taking champagne, cigars, and pistachio ice cream. That's essentially the charges against him. Did he take?
But also for influencing between deals with the media as well.
Okay. That's also a great point. Yeah. Could you imagine that? Could you imagine that that's considered? I mean, I'm amazed. So Netanyahu was doing deals where he was trying to get editors to write positive stories about him. You want to tell me that there isn't, that Tony Blair didn't do the same thing with Rupert Murdoch? I mean, Murdoch is a conservative and he suddenly goes pro Blair. Now, did Blair do any deals? I have no idea. But every single thing tries to get positive coverage. When we speak about corruption, we usually speak about huge amounts of money that have changed hands or huge, like right now, Hunter Biden. I think Joe Biden is not corrupt. I think he's an honest man. And I'm kind of saddened about what's happening to his son, Hunter, because his son, Hunter, you'll see behind me an ad that says Melissa Batcha Biden. We took out a full page ad after October 7th.
Right.
Appealing to Joe Biden and his son, Hunter, credit his Jewish daughter-in-law, Melissa Batcha Cohen Biden, for saving Hunter Biden's life. You know, he was a heroin addict. And she sends her kids to the Chabad school in California. So she's a very committed Jew. So we took out a full page ad in the New York Times asking her, go to you're like Esther. You're a Jewish woman, marries into the most powerful family on earth. So I'm saddened by Hunter Biden's problem issues. But remember, Hunter Biden, we're talking hundreds of thousands of dollars. Netanyahu, we're talking about champagne. I mean, when they went after him for the $3,800 in the pistachio ice cream that was ordered to.
Right.
A lot of this has been a little bit ridiculous. Is Netanyahu a great leader? I believe he's a great leader. Is he a polarizing leader? Yes, absolutely. And I think you cannot be a leader of consequence if you're not polarizing today.
Sure, but I think that most people object not so much to the pink champagne and the cigars and all the rest of it, but more to the judicial reforms, which people feel that he's in hock to the extremists in his cabinet and he's trying to divide the country and reshape the democratic system to make it more authoritarian and all the rest of it. I don't have to tell you what the criticisms are, but I think people are more worried about those.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So you see, you just pivoted to something very with great gravitas, very serious. I agree with you. The judicial reform thing, I think, was a mistake. Not that it was carried out at all, but the way it was carried out. Everyone agrees that the two branches, Israel has two branches of government, America has three. Everyone agrees that Israel, that the two branches of government were out of sync. That the Supreme Court, having the right to simply say, to override the will of the people without a constitution, here in America, we have a constitution, And to say that this thing is unreasonable was a bit ridiculous. But they took it too far because they went, they kind of degraded. It was imbalanced, it was done out of kilter, and it was a mistake. You're not going to see that come back for a long time. Yeah. I agree with that.
I just
don't agree with ridiculous corruption stuff like champagne and cigars. Bringing down a leader who has the mandate of the people over a couple of cigars seems a bit extreme to me. Anyway.
Okay. Well, just so that we've only got a few minutes left, Rabbi Shmuley. So just to finish off, could you give us some note of optimism? These are dark times, both in the diaspora and in Israel. What note of optimism and hope can people take away with them?
Oh, I'm nothing but optimistic because I am fully engaged in the fight for the Jewish people. If Descartes were Jewish and if he were alive today, he would say, I fight, therefore I am. Jews are fighters. The word Israel means a fighter. We forget that. We're not called Jacob, which is the heel. You know, Jacob had two names. We have three fathers, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. Really, Jacob's our father. We're all Israelites. We're not called Abrahamites. We're not called Isaacites. Jacob is the father of the 12 tribes. But he had two names, and we could have been called Jacobites. Thank God we're not. That's a British term.
Jacobites, yeah.
We're not involved in revolutions against the British crown, et cetera. But Jacob means the heel. Israel, God gave him a new name, and that name means he who fights with God, even with God. Where was God on October 7th? Did God watch as Shani Luke's body was paraded naked? Did God watch the 350 young people whose only sin was to be merry on Simchat Torah, even if they were doing it with a band? Did God watch the babies who were decapitated? Did God watch what I saw? I was there a week after the attack, blood congealed to 3 to 5 inches on the floor. We wrestle even with God. We fight even with God. I brought Elie Wiesel to the Oxford Union 30 years ago where he gave a speech challenging God in front of 1,000 Oxford students who sat there with tears streaming down their cheeks and they were in awe. I'm a fighter. I'm going to fight for our people. We're going to fight the UN's bias. We're going to fight the media bias. We're going to fight Hamas. I have two sons who are IDF soldiers. We have three kids who served in the IDF. Once you have kids who go to war, it's a totally different thing. Your Shabbats go to hell. You begin to hate Shabbat because you're not going to have contact with your sons and know that they're okay. Your whole life changes, and you have to have conversations. As you know, when the war started, I said to my wife, "We have two sons in the war, and our sons, you know, our son was like really, literally on the front line, giving us so much anxiety." I said, "We have to begin to think as parents, as Israeli parents, have, and not have anxiety over Shabbat, and not to think the worst, God forbid, every time we hear that someone was injured. We have to fight, and the." I'm nothing but optimistic because I have never seen the Jewish people fight like we are today. Listen, when I was the rabbi at Oxford University and expanded the L'Chaim Society to London, Oxford, Cambridge, Jake, a lot of the people I was fighting with fellow Jews who said, you're a brash American who's loud and boisterous and you don't know how we do things in Britain. I'm not here to say I told you so because I didn't get everything right. But the one thing I think that I was with others was correct about was that you can't think this stuff is just going to go away. It's not the wave of British anti-Semitism, things like the media bias to the BBC, et cetera. It wasn't just a passing wave. It was going to become ingrained unless you got on TV and began to respond to it. I have never seen British Jewry fight as hard as they are now. I've never seen Australian Jewry fight as hard as they are now. American Jewry, Israel. I am more optimistic than I've ever been because while it is true that our numbers are small, and we had 18 million Jews before the Holocaust, and maybe we're at 15 million. So we haven't even replaced those numbers. You know, Poland has almost tripled in numbers since Britain has doubled, France. While we remain so small, 14 million people, if even 10% or 20% are fighters in the media, social media, on TV, in the army, philanthropy, you've got 3 million fighters. That's how many soldiers, Yimach Shemo, may Hitler burn, roast in hell, and may his name be erased. That's how many soldiers he sent to take over the entire Soviet Union, 3 million one day, Operation Barbarossa. If we had Lahavdil, to go from the extreme unholiness to the holy, if we had 3 million Jewish fighters, we'll win this war. And I think we're getting there. Jews are more engaged than ever. The Jewish Chronicle is doing it. I've never seen Jews prepared to finally take the gloves off and fight without fear. What are they going to think about us? No, we are fighters. We fight for our good name. We fight the lie of colonization. We fight the lie of occupation. We fight the lie that we're not indigenous to the people. You know, in this room not long ago, Bobby Kennedy Jr., with whom I've become very close, and okay, so we have two people running for president, Biden and Trump, but Bobby Kennedy is polling at 20% nationally as an independent. And of course, his father was the first significant American casualty of Palestinian terrorism in American history. He was murdered. Bobby Kennedy Sr. was murdered by Sirhan Sirhan, June 5th, 1968. And in this room on a Shabbat, me and Bobby Kennedy debated the whole Israel-Palestine thing. And I know he's a very religious Catholic, as are all the Kennedys. They take their Catholicism very seriously. And I said, how often do you read the Bible? He said, every morning. I said, okay, I want you to tell me, where's the mention of the Palestinians in the book of Mark or the book of Matthew or in Acts of the Apostles or in the book of Revelation? He said, there is none. I said, exactly. I said, the Arabs, with the death of Muhammad, they conquered within 60 years of death of the prophet. They conquered most, you know, almost half the world, including Palestine. What the Romans began to call Philip, they resurrected the ancient Philistina, Palestine, in order to degrade the Jewish attachment to the land. It was called Judea during the Roman emperors. I said, even your Bible says that we're indigenous. And your father, Bobby Kennedy Sr., was so famous during his campaign for the 1968 presidency for visiting the indigenous peoples, people we used to call American Indians. Of course, that's a pejorative. We call them Native Americans. I said, we Jews are native. He said, then why weren't you there? I said, I'll tell you why. Because it is a story of apartheid. A white colonial European occupier called Rome came and annihilated us and took us and enslaved the rest of us. We were more dark-skinned back then. It was a typical story. And they brought us to Europe. We had no political power. We had no power whatsoever. And finally, there was a renaissance in Europe where they gave Jews a few rights to move around. They started moving back. And there was always a Jewish presence there as well. We are the right. indigenous. And we're making these arguments now and people are listening. And the BBC knows that they're now accountable. And CNN knows that they're accountable. The New York Times knows that they're accountable. Look at all these ads that my organization, the World Values Network, takes out. I mean, we've done hundreds. They're not cheap. But when the New York Times attacks Israel, we can't always change their editorial policy, but we sure as heck can take out a full-page ad and show how they're factually wrong, and it makes them more careful. So I am nothing optimistic. We are fighting like never before. I see the Jews, to paraphrase, the greatest of all, the greatest, you know, it's funny. I've done many debates on Israel in Britain recently on Piers Morgan and come to London for those debates.
Yeah.
And I've pointed out that Winston Churchill, you know, America during the war, during the Second World War, used daytime precision bombing. And they were aghast that the British did nighttime area bombing.
Right.
Because Churchill said, no, my pilots' lives are more important than the German civilians who voted this guy into power, et cetera. And I said to Mohammed Ijab on the Piers Morgan show, was Winston Churchill a terrorist? And by the way, Israel would never do any such thing. Israel does no carpet bombing. Sure. They only do precision bombing. They do what the Americans did, and even more precise. I mean, technology has changed. And then Mohammed Ijab in front of Piers Morgan says famously, yes, based on that, absolutely, Winston Churchill was a terrorist. And that became national headlines the next day over that debate with Piers Morgan. But I bring that up because I consider Winston Churchill the man to have saved Western civilization. I consider him to have been the greatest of all British prime ministers. And while he was a Zionist, while he has a mixed record on Jews being allowed into, he was a great friend of the Jewish people. He defeated Hitler. So to paraphrase Winston Churchill and arguably his greatest speech of the Second World War, I am nothing but optimistic as a Jew because we are now fighting them on the beaches. We're fighting them in the landing strips. We're fighting them in TikTok. We're fighting them on Instagram. We are fighting on social media. We are fighting in paid media. We are fighting in demonstrations. We will never surrender. So I am nothing but optimistic. We're going to win.
Right. Well, Rabbi Shmuley, thank you so much for joining us. I thought I would finish by saying Yachad Nenetzach. Then I thought I would finish by saying Am Yisrael Chai. Then I thought I would say Chazak, Chazak, Benit Chazek. Maybe that's the most appropriate way to finish.
By the way, Jake, let me just say, first of all three are beautiful. Thank you. Chazak, Chazak, Benit Chazek. We need to get stronger. Let me just say something from the heart. When I lived in England for 11 years, like every Jew in Britain, the Jewish Chronicle was something you not only read, but you waited for it, like every Friday. And it was the principal organ of Anglo-Jewry. And it was the oldest, most prestigious Jewish publication. When I was asked to do this podcast, I did not know I was going to be interviewed, A, by the actual editor of the Jewish Chronicle, and B, by a former Oxford alum. So both have been a very pleasant surprise, and I've greatly enjoyed this conversation. You are editing a critical. We Jews have always sucked at public relations. We've been terrible. And the Jewish Chronicle was founded, was almost visionary in knowing that the Jews needed a voice. And the prestige and the credibility that comes from your publication is critical, not just to Anglo Jewry, but to world Jewry. So thank you for your work. And I'm very grateful and I'm honored to have done this interview, and God bless you.
You've been listening to the Israel War Briefing from the Jewish Chronicle with me, Jake Wallace-Simons. Join us next time for more insight and analysis from leading experts.